I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It was painted red, the stripe was white, it was 18 feet from the bow to the stern light. Second hand from a dealer in Atlanta, I rode up with Daddy when he went there to get her. Put on a shine, put on a motor, built out of love, made for water.
Alan Jackson singing a song called Drive, which is an awesome song because he sings about an engine.
Just an old plywood boat, 75 Johnson, electric choke.
You don't hear the lyrics 75 Johnson with an electric choke too often, but joining me is the Air Officer for 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, all the guys here from Kilo Company, and Patrick Puck Gulogli.
It's on target.
Am I close?
That's on target.
I met Patrick a couple days ago now, and... Patrick, first of all, we've got to learn about you to find out if we can believe you. So, born and raised, Marine shit, right? Born and raised where?
East Greenwich, Rhode Island.
Rhode Island guy. And
Red Sox Nation.
How does the, I know, we don't need to go there. How does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Maybe the parents' divorce caused me to really kind of crave camaraderie. Certainly stories of my grandfather's Second World War service. Maybe now I'm approaching
in the Marine Corps?
No, the Navy, a surface warfare officer in those days. So approaching junior high, really kind of craving the hockey team camaraderie, now football, and I'm really getting focused on the military. And I can look you in the face and tell you, definitely a passion, a lifelong passion for military history. And my father, to his credit, said, hey, my dad didn't serve, but... maybe it's time to get over the euphoria of a film like Top Gun and realize, listen, you're going to go in the service, you could get killed, and if you're going to be serious about it, you should really focus on it. And so, therefore, it's time to join the varsity, right? And it's starting to look at the Marine Corps as of junior high school.
Wow.
Took a real hard look at the Naval Academy and maybe missed the mark by a few hundred meters there, but I got into Navy prep naps in Newport, Rhode Island, and a simple decision, hey, that's a five-year path. I got into West Point but want to be a Marine, and when the Citadel offered a full scholarship, that was a perfect path for me. So from the Rhode Island to the Citadel, but focused on the Corps, and then a PLC slot for aviation was one of the biggest blessings of my life.
Yeah. You knew you wanted to fly?
No, Mac. I put in for ground and air. I wanted to be a Marine officer, and it just so happened I got an air slot. I put in for both.
But a hockey player?
You bet. Lifelong.
And does the Citadel have a hockey team?
It does now. It didn't in those days. And I got offered a little money under the table to play for Norwich Academy. Me, but I said it's time to go to the varsity military school, so I went down to the Citadel, said goodbye to hockey for just a little window of time, picked it back up years later, but the Citadel was the right path for me, and then a PLC air slot.
All right, and so you're a Huey pilot.
Yes.
And you participate in the march up as a Huey pilot.
I did. It was my third deployment, sure. Yeah.
And then you go to do a ground tour with 3-1?
Yeah, and you back up. I had done a Renefact tour with 1-4. So, yeah, a Huey driver, co-pilot in 99 to Okinawa, an aircraft commander, 31st MEU in 2001. Had the privilege of staying with the squadron, extending with the squadron, which I volunteered and asked to do, and was lucky to do that. So OAF-1, the march up, it was my third deployment. I was an aircraft commander and a section leader. And now, that summer, I was 1 month too junior for the majors board. So what am I going to do? I have, if you will, a free year, and I loved serving with the infantry, so I volunteered to go back. And then these Marines may didn't tell you, 3-1 at first was going to be like a UDP. Well, it wasn't going to be a UDP, but it was going to be a MU, and then that changed to this, that, and the other. And then, you know, as you know, November, for a few days, I'll be careful with the sister battalions, might not like it, but we were the main effort battalion in 2nd Fallujah. So it changed over time, a MU, this, that, and the other. And now you're going to OAF-2B under Major General James Mattis, and no, it was a privilege. Yeah.
All right, and you were the battalion air officer.
Exactly right.
The how did you hear about this program? Tell us about coming up here. Now, first of all, what are you doing today? You retired when?
I retired two summers ago. Yeah, so one September of 18, I retired, and I've been flying life flight civilian life flight helicopters ever since in Southeast Colorado. I flew my first patient the day I retired, so that was a privilege. But yeah, we live in the, I married a lovely lady from Sweden, and gave her the pin and let her put it wherever in the map. We took a look at this state, Montana, and took a look at Alaska, but with a special needs son, I think Colorado was the right pick for us. So been a privilege to fly civilian life flight, and like you, I'm getting a lot of fulfillment out of it, and right. It certainly ain't about dollars, right? But yeah, Colorado. Yeah.
The so how do you hear about this?
So Brian and I, of course, have been fast friends since the battalion.
Tell everybody who Brian is.
Excuse me. This is the final day, actually final hour for me here at the Bar-X fishing trip here in southern Montana. Phenomenal 4 days. And they sponsored Brahma, 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, Fallujah Vets. And so the other four men are all from Lima Company. I'm the battalion air officer, but you had the company commander, Brian Heatherman, and then three at the time staff sergeants who now have gone on to great things. So it's a privilege to be with four Lima Marines and myself, the company commander, Brian Heatherman, great man. He had been the H&S company commander. Another captain kind of got wayward and was hard relieved, and Brian was then put into the line as Lima company commander, and he and I have been friends ever since. So the answer to your question is Brian reached out to me, and to his credit, Brian had heard about this from Fightin' Fred Galvin. So thanks so much to Fred, a good friend of mine. Fightin' Fred. The answer is Fightin' Fred was the link. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So talk so coming up here, what was your expectations, and what do you think? I got here 2 days ago, and I always say, there's no warmer place in the world, no safer place than being in the company of Marines. And then I was in Ramadi when you guys were down in Fallujah, and watched what you guys did, and just walk in the door, and it's just this aura that you feel when you walk in. Tell me about your experience here.
Yeah, no, it's been outstanding. I'm really glad that they don't bring, say, five Marines from 5 points of the compass. You know, they bring those of us who not only serve together, but in this case, you know, we served in combat together. So the answer to that question would be camaraderie, right? And I'm sure like you and all those years ago, 1983, I came in the Marine Corps for the right reasons. I came in the more peaceful years in the early 90s, OCS in 92, 94. And that was part, and I've already answered it, part of why I came in was the camaraderie, right? So Brahma, to Willard Buell's undying credit, is absolutely a brotherhood, right? And I've seen different battalion and many, many squadron commanders, but what he did truly was to kind of, he unleashed us through like a brotherhood, right? And he didn't worry about moving chess pieces around. He let the phenomenal operations officer Christian Griffin do that. But you could tell he was always about the team. And I told you before, I'll say it for the ninth time, but that doesn't mean everyone's on the team. And he hard relieved men, but if you're on the team, you felt like a first string all stater. And then those men that were kicked off the team, well, they were wayward for some
reason.
And that's
his job. He manages personnel.
And he did it.
He fills out the lineup card, and then once the lineup card's filled, right?
And I've seen, like you, you've seen men give seven strikes. There were two strikes, right? So unlike the Sox, there's two strikes.
No, when you play, you bet your life.
Absolutely.
And you know what's interesting?
So the answer is camaraderie.
Right. The interesting thing about Colonel Buell, and Willie Buell as he's known, is a lot of guys are afraid to do that. A lot of guys are afraid to relieve people. General Mattis wasn't, and the 1st Marine Division performed at a really, really high level, because I think a lot of very mediocre guys knew that if I don't have my ass and my brain wired together, he's going to launch my shit. Yeah. And so I think, the good guys are always good, but I think the difference in – and again, I've learned a lot, because when you go higher in an organization, you're going to have some great performers. The trick is to get the mid-level performers to perform as above average performers, right? And sadly, a lot of that is fear.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But yet to focus on the team ethos, right? Right. So it's not about the Lefwich Trophy. It's not about the top of the Christmas tree. Ultimately, if you're going to go into heavy combat, it is the team. And I don't know about you, Mac, but I can smell people who, God bless them, maybe they were combat tourists over there or whatever. They were not in heavy combat, and you can sense that they couldn't spell team. And even some of those men go into great things in the Marine Corps. Okay. But I had the privilege of serving in intense combat, and we did it with a team that I get emotional just thinking about. So and then the answer to that question is camaraderie. So I don't give a shit who it was going to be from Brahma. If they were going to be from Brahma, the odds are they'd remember me. And if I didn't know them specifically, I'd know their faces. And these were leaders. These were staff sergeants. I remember all three of them. And we were emotional in the airport. Yeah.
Yeah, what was that like? Yeah, I mean, when was the last time you saw these guys?
Well, I stay in touch with Brian. I've seen Brian. But the other three, it was those days, right? You know, and I would have left the battalion in probably March, April, right? Just a few months after we came home. And so,
Which was the case for a lot of units because, sure. You know, the Marine Corps had, like all the services, stop loss and, sure. You know, guys are supposed to come to units. They're on hold, and families are on hold. Right. And so, you know, you come home, and then all of a sudden there's this explosion of personnel.
Right.
Then it gets put back together very quickly, starts pre-deployment training to get ready to go back again. So it's pretty turbulent times.
That's exactly right.
Give me the high points of being up here.
Now, seriously, and even last night, it's like anything else you talked about. It was you that talked about a lobster. He feels that pressure, and now he's got to go to the next
shell. Video.
Well, literally last night, we may have had some of the best bonding last night knowing that, okay, shit, we're getting on planes tomorrow, you know. So last night was special, but the whole thing was special. And I haven't been in any dark places, but I know that something meditative/relaxing, enjoyable, fresh air is right on target. There's no doubt about it, you know. And that all that was great too. And I wasn't in my own boat floating on the river. I was with Brian Heatherman, right? And we were talking the whole time. I was friends with him when he met his wife. You know, it was great to re-link, and then to see the staff sergeants. These senior leaders now are phenomenal men. You know, Van Dale, Mike with the red shirt last night. You find someone who killed more enemy with his own hands in Fallujah, good luck. But phenomenal. And it's not about that. It, for them, it's about leadership, right? As a staff sergeant, building to building to building to building for 12, 14 days.
Yeah. No, just awesome guys. You got a chance to see what I do, which is post-traumatic winning. What were you? I mean, you're no stranger to, you know, programs about mental health and shit like that. I mean, so what were your thoughts before, and then what were your thoughts as you watched it, and then and afterward?
I think it was great. I had the privilege to be not only an educated man, but to teach at the Naval War College. So years and years ago, on my own initiative, I've read Lord Moore, and I've read. And a lot of military history, but it is neat to see, maybe not just to fix it and get it back on plane again. And to his credit, General Mattis had me think about post-traumatic growth, but you alluded to it that, you go higher again, and now you're personifying it in that you're helping people not just to maybe get back, but to go beyond and then...
To win.
Not just military, right? You said some of the most powerful stuff with the civilians, and I see car crashes, not every month, I don't want to oversell it, but we certainly see some trauma in Life Flight. I think it's outstanding. I think it's outstanding.
Well, and I would tell you, I mean, the nurses that you work with that see that stuff on a regular basis, and you know that if you're not afraid to ask two questions, hey, could I talk to you?
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with you. And
let's
and
get
really,
you off the schedule tomorrow. Or, right. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and so, but leveraging, you know, your combat experiences for all this good that can be that comes straight from our culture. No, I mean, I had so many wonderful conversations yesterday afternoon and last night with I had one with you.
Sure.
You know, I had one with Dan, you know, and I mean, I had one with everybody. It was all, I mean, it was amazing because as guys had time to think about it and where this could go, right? The gunny was dogging my shit. Hey, I'm coming to work. I'm coming to work for you. Yeah. Right? I'm coming to work for you. But no, you said, and you know, I mean, you're a hockey player.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite sport. Right, my sons both played. I coached.
Yeah.
I played. I took playing.
Yeah.
I took playing. I took up playing hockey, born and raised in California, at the age of 29.
Good for you.
I couldn't even skate.
Yeah.
So I started to go to public skate. A friend of mine, we were instructors at the basic school.
Skating's A1, buddy. There's no doubt.
But, I mean, you don't do it as a kid, but I love the sport.
Yeah.
And I think if the Marine Corps ever embraced the sport, it would be ice hockey because of the – you hear stuff yelled off a hockey bench that you don't hear yelled off any other team sport.
And there's unique camaraderie because it's a physical sport in hockey and in football as well.
And – but I think the difference in hockey as opposed to football, in hockey, from a young age, you're expected to stand up for your teammates.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And if somebody freight trains one of your teammates and it's dirty –
yeah, absolutely.
The puck is now a secondary consideration,
absolutely,
dependent on the score and the time left in the game. And you're expected to go defend your teammate and go get that guy. And I think that's so good for young boys because we don't teach that anymore. And then, I mean, when you come into Marine Corps, it is the same ethos.
Absolutely.
And so to me, the significance of post-traumatic winning is, especially guys like you and me who played sports, I mean, winning, right?
Yeah.
Not coexisting, not endurance.
Tie.
Fuck
yeah.
That,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's we joined the Marine Corps because we wanted to be on the best team, and this whole concept of winning. And now what I love about post-traumatic winning is, okay, boys, here's the path to get to that place.
Yeah.
And then every one of these guys came up to me and said, wow, I know I can do that. And I know not only can I do it, I can take other people there.
Yeah.
Hello.
Well, I'll give you a thought. You know, I flew with HMLA 169 in the march up, big HMLA, 27 gunships, 355 Marines. We had the privilege to support RCT-7 in my case, and the Cobras supported it all, RCT-5, 1, and 7. But from my foxhole or from my cockpit, it went really well, and I had the privilege to shoot up targets and fly CAS and also fly generals around. But the trauma would have been less personal, and we did lose a Huey. We lost the aircraft destroyed, the aircraft that had had my name on it before we deployed, and then the co-pilot was ejected, so he survived, but three killed. But that was it was not dispassionate, but I wasn't there when it happened, right. And then the aircraft 39 just gone, and you know, with Brahma it's different, right? And you see it up close and personal. Now these four men last night were truly up close and personal, and one was the captain writing letters and his Marines going into those buildings. I might be unique in that. Now, my second deployment, not only I earned Colonel Buell's trust, but we had a very unique opportunity. We were plussed up with an extra forwarder controller above TO. So now we have four forwarder controllers, a battalion officer, IKL, and we were able to put a hurricane of airstrikes together under Gary Kling's leadership, you bet.
Don't tell me he's a good guy. I texted him last night.
First string of the varsity, man. Come on. He's captain of the D1. And then Kevin O'Rourke. So I had my own foxhole, but what a privilege to serve with those men. Gary Kling at Division, Frantic O'Rourke at Regiment, myself at Battalion, Porchop Smay, Mo Green, and then Carl Lowe. Are you kidding me? And we represented all four trigger
MOSs
of the Marine Corps, Huey, Cobra, F-18, and Harrier.
Tell me how many airstrikes. I mean, tell people. I mean, you were talking about the number of airstrikes you guys ran, and we won't name the adjacent organization, but give people – I mean – you guys leaned into that, and tell everybody how much you guys ran as opposed to an adjacent unit.
Yeah, we leaned into it too as the casualties ramped up, and we conducted 276 airstrikes in 12 days.
Holy shit, man. That's a lot.
Yeah.
And the adjacent unit?
Considerably less. The adjacent regiment. Now, 3-5 was controlling airstrikes, you bet. And I'm sure 3-5 was in the triple digits, but the sister regiment was a different story.
Just for the record, they were in double digits.
The regiment, yes.
The regiment was in double digits, and the double digits were above or below 50?
Below.
Below 50. So it gives you some kind of contrast in terms of, you know, how people did that.
And some of that was true that we did have a lot of dirt to clear. I know we dealt with some of the most enemy from a battalion perspective. And then what was even brought up last night was, you know, Major General Richard Natonsky, right? Richard said, you clear every single structure. I can look you in the eyes and tell you that 3-1 did. And I know that different battalions were a different conception. Maybe.
Everybody kind of starts with the train station, right?
Well, 3-1
right.
takes the train station.
Right.
Sister
and
battalions
so
are different.
Yep. Different, but if you're looking for a landmark relative to Fallujah, that is essentially
from the north,
the horizontal, you know,
absolutely.
Limit. So, and you guys were, you know, dead center of the city? Give everybody a sense of which part of the city you guys fought through.
Tally-ho. So if we attacked the city from north to south, and so on the far right, it would have been to the far west, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. And part of the pre-battle conception was they might deal with the teeth of the enemy in the Jolan, the Janai, I still remember the names, the Janabi tribe. Right. And so in general, they're going to be assigned the northwest corner, which may be the worst for shithead enemy. And then 3-1 will be on their left to the east, and we're going to go south and then hook to the river. And then later our conception became even bigger. And then we had 2-7 cavalry with us, not attached to Brahma, but subordinate to the regiment. So 2-7 cav, 44 tanks and brads, 90 dismounts. They were kind of an armored thrust. And really what they did, to their credit, was herringbone all the intersections. But Brahma's got the dismounts, right? We got 1,400 Marines. So we're clear in the structures. Phase line Henry, north to south. All the north-south avenues were male names. East-west were female. So phase line Henry divided RC T1 Inchon, Michael Shupp commanding, Colonel Michael Shupp, and then to the, it would have been what, the east was RCT7 under, I believe, Tucker, Colonel Tucker, to the east. So phase line Henry to the right or to the west was our dirt. And then it was from my foxhole, it was 12 days. I talked to some of the staff NCOs. Yeah, they think of it more about 14 days. And the 8th was the first day, but we also loaded the attack position. We just sat in that attack position during the day, a gray day with some drizzle. And just like I'd been taught at TBS, when things are slow, man, you got to rest. I remember trying to, like, rest. I just couldn't fucking close my, you know, couldn't fall asleep. And so really the 9th, kind of day one of the fighting, and they'll tell you 14 days. Yep.
What do you take away from this?
The camaraderie was great. To see it in their eyes and then to talk about it. And the point I was driving at, so I had the privilege to fly over 100 missions in the march up. Now I'm with Brahma. It was all going right. And now to have a man like Colonel Buell, who had implicit trust, and I know that I had earned that, you know, when we're in that attack position, that man put both hands on both of my shoulders and he said, "Puck, airstrike approval is granted. You will bounce that grid off another Marine every single time." Right? He didn't want me doing Alpha Bravo 1007 alone at 3 a.m. And that was, of course, sage advice. And then away we went.
And it's so sage because if the more time you spent doing that, when you get tired, the first thing that goes is your ability to do numbers straight. And when you see bad things that happen because of numbers that got transposed, normally fatigue.
500-pound bomb.
Right. Yeah. Normally fatigue had a lot to do with it. And the size of the ordnance back then, I mean, as the wars evolve, you know, we get smaller ordnance, to be a little bit more nuanced. Sure. But in that fight, we didn't have that.
Correct. And the ROE was absolutely was liberal, and the city had been not only warned, it had been bermed, and we really did everything in the United States Marine Corps' power to warn people and let civilians get out. Right. Unfortunately, some civilians were probably co-opted at gunpoint to stay. Right. Shitheads are saying, "You're going to fucking tell these people I'm your cousin from wherever," you know.
That's their decision, and right. and those poor people, so unfortunate. But you're right. I mean, we did everything to include, you know, leaflet drops and loudspeakers with Iraqis talking
supersonic
and all that.
We did a supersonic flyby, like a few days before, literally. And it was louder than I thought.
Please leave.
Yeah.
Please leave.
Yeah. You know, and to his credit, now you taught at TBS, is that right? Yeah. So, of course, I was, you know, Alpha Company, basically a PLC company back in 95, 96. But to his credit, one of the instructors from whatever they call it, the infantry, one of the TBS instructors, I'll never forget. I don't really remember his name. Hard African American infantry captain. He had told us, like you got to plan sleep, man, and think of sleep as another weapon. And if you don't, and he was on target. And I even thought of that in Fallujah. And I've never been so tired. But, you know, the circadian would help you during the day. You'd get circadian up, and obviously caffeine, right? But also, never
explain to everybody circadian.
I'm an aviator, right? So. Day 3, day 4, day 5, I can look you in the face and tell you there were in excess of 4, 5, 6 days I didn't sleep a wink. And so now, even me thinking, like you said, Ooh, day seven, man, and you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's fuck, the grid's wrong. Fuck, you know, that would be the nightmare. And maybe the bombs come off the rail with the wrong grid, which never happened, but that would be the nightmare. I really thought about how am I going to stay sharp? So when the sun is up, we are driven by light. Circadian rhythms are driven by light. So in general, when the sun's up, you're going to be up, and that's when the enemy wanted to play. And I can tell you with pride that, look, it was never physical for me. I was at the battalion train station just coordinating the airstrikes. And like I told you, pulling air out of the architecture and then giving it to the forward air controllers. For them, sometimes they were running between buildings. And then their radio operators are putting up the 2902 antenna on the top. That 2902 antenna is very specific, and the enemy's not stupid, and he got smarter. What's the point? The point is the forward air controllers, it's physical. They're running between buildings. The enemy wants to play during the day, but we can use our lethality and our sensors at night. And once we started taking serious casualties, and our battalion suffered more than any of the battalions.
What, like 32 killed in action?
In the deployment, 33, 405 PCRs for the deployment. In the battle, 23 killed, 275 wounded.
PCR is a personal casualty report.
Correct. For the deployment. 33 killed, 405 personal casualty reports for the deployment in the battle. And the staff sergeant taught me, right, 14 days of high intensity, 23 killed, 275 wounded. Now, as you know, and I've already told you, some of those are what, just a thumb and they're back in it. But others were sucking chest, eyes, you know, or limbs. So day three, day four, day five, we're taking casualties. Now I took it upon myself to use that lethality. And like I'd been taught and trained, this was now an opportunity, right? It's incredible lethality. And our procedures were tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. No one had done anywhere near as many airstrikes as we had. So I would start to go after the enemy at night, right? Based on, first of all, reactive close air support, weapons caches, and then preparing where Kilo Company is going to go tomorrow. I face-to-face with the Kilo Company commander. He said, Puck, they're in the big structures, man. They're in these big structures, mouth holes in the interior walls. We deal with the eastern part of the structure, and goddammit, now they're in the west. And so helping the infantry go after the large structures was a privilege with AC-130 and fast mover bombs. And I love my community, but for us, we weren't bringing Hueys and Cobras over the urban terrain. We're going to use them on what I called waterfront property, the periphery of the city.
You tell other guys to come to stuff like this?
Absolutely, Smurfly. Absolutely. And again, yeah, you wouldn't want five Marines from the 5 points of the compass, but Marines who serve together, HMLA 169, it's incredible. Yeah.
Patrick Puck Gulgogli.
That's off target. Gulogli.
Gulogli. Shit. First of all, thanks for doing this.
Thank you. And thanks for what you do.
I hope our paths cross in the future.
Yeah, I'd seen you somewhere at Camp Penn. I was at Camp Penn for 12 years.
That's what he said. But no, I hope that you know, the opportunity, whether it's doing this for nurses and doctors, you know, it's as you know, I always
firemen,
say, it's not a military thing. It's not a Marine thing. We can help anybody, and you'll stand up and play James's part. I'll do my thing, and hopefully we'll change lives. But it's been awesome.
Yeah, thanks for what you do. Absolutely.
No, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, that'll do it here on a Monday. We got to get in the car and get moving. So that'll do it today. I'll do this again tomorrow from a different part of Montana, and do post-traumatic winning again tomorrow. So as somebody told me last night, Sergeant Major told me, you got the coolest post-active duty job I've ever seen, and it's true, because this experience with the love that you feel in the room that's based on their service together, their shared camaraderie, their shared danger, the death they shared together, and then being able to show them, as Patrick just said, like, there's a mountaintop that you can go to, and we can win. We don't have to endure this. I get to do it all over again, and Patrick has to go back to work. So go ahead.
What a privilege. Yeah, thanks so much. No, and I help people as well. But one final thought was, it's not a day goes by I don't think about our casualties. But for me, I was able to do the job and haven't gone in a dark place I said it at some friends' funerals, but I mean it, that I think those guys, they want us to live, right? They want us to live.
And they want us to win.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the smile that they would get on their faces, and this is my opinion, to hear us talking about winning and us talking about changing the lives of the people around us, and that we as veterans would use that experience to take other people to a place they don't even know exists, I would tell you, not only bring tears to our eyes, but would bring tears to their eyes.
Absolutely.
And then looking at us and saying, hey, we're proud of you. Thank you. And God bless you for you know, having the toughness and the smarts to take other people there.
Absolutely.
So, no. All right. With that said, on a Monday, Almarine Radio, over and out.